have it all around us. That's why I'm saying it is something that may be threatening our lives. Sometimes one may behave with nifaq with Muslims and sometimes with God's creatures belonging to other communities and creeds. Nifaq can show itself in different forms pertaining to the status of the person having this deadly disease. For a layman, it can be seen in boasting of faith in Islam, sincerity of faith and piety. For scholars and jurisprudents, pretending the highest degree of sincerity and putting forth claims to be the best person and also following the prophets. For the scholars of philosophy and rational science, claiming to possess true faith and knowledge based on deductive proofs. So we do have the signs and the devastating effects of nifaq around us, giving oneself right to harass and hurt subordinates and never hesitate to cause them inconveniences. They are the signs that we need to open our eyes to and try to understand that if I am really stating that I'm a true Muslim, deep down I should stay the eager and enthusiast who is following the teachings of the Islam, of the religion.
Your mercy, your love is all I need. All I need. All I need.
As a Muslim, yeah, I understood the hypocrisy and the fact that I have to be far from those signs and symptoms. But what if I really do have this urge and now I want the treatment? So what should I do and how can it be solved? If a person is afflicted with this ugly disease, first of all, we should think about the harms that it may cause in our personality and the features that we do have. A person with nifaq will ultimately fail to achieve any merits and to reach his higher goals. As we have it mentioned in Quran as well, that the people who are following the way of hypocrisy are never going to understand what they want and what the true destination for them is going to be. In the hereafter, where secrets that remained concealed from the eyes of people shall not be hidden there. He will be raised as a deformed, ugly creature possessing two tongues of fire and punished along with the hypocrisy, evils, and the devil himself. Therefore, it is important for a man of wisdom who sees no good in it but harms. We are supposed to open our eyes and see the ugliness and the fact that we need to get rid of this urgent need in ourselves. If one preserves in the exercise of stopping themselves from hypocrisy, from not trying to have the double-facedness, for several days or even years, our soul will become purified and the rust of hypocrisy and double-facedness will be removed from it. The mirror of our heart and the inner being will be cleansed of this vice, and it will be ready again to receive the favors and blessings of the bestower, the creator, because at the same time when we are trying to follow the way of hypocrisy, our creator, for sure we have it, like he promised in Quran that he is not after the people who are having double faces, like people who claim to follow the way of truth and the creator, but at the same time they are not following the orders deep down. They are being neglectful towards the really powerful God, the first cause of their downfall, of the fact that they are not going to be having a safe and secure situation in heaven, is nothing but the fact that they are neglectful toward the Creator. And with this state of mind, asserting faith in the unity of God is nothing but just the slogans that they claim to have, but in their heart they are not going to believe in them. Things that are said, but looking at their actions, nothing can be said. So the story of Sa'di was also mentioning the same notes, that if a person is just trying to hide, the last line, if you remember, the outside of the hypocrisy's coat is neater than the lining, for the one is seen and the other is hidden. Relating it to the fact that in the hereafter, people are going to be judged with the concealed part of the personality, with the thing that they tried and did their best to hide from the rest of the people. when looking at the future, looking at the destination, we are not going to be hiding anything, neither from the Creator nor from the creations, like from people around us. So what better than solving this problem, this disease in our minds, and try to go for the way of the Almighty Creator and try to understand that hypocrisy is a disease threatening our lives, of course, around us, but it is not something that we cannot get along with. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes, and we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor 'cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact, to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied?
After the wars of Israel and the repeated defeats of Arabs, Israel seeks to consolidate its permanent position. It expels Palestinians, hides documents, forges records, and seizes empty lands. Then it transfers Druze from other countries to Israel to form the lower classes of society as cheap labor. On the other side, Palestinians, after forced migration, set up camps in neighboring countries. The camps were supposed to be temporary until the time the Palestinians were able to return to their motherland. But the camps have turned into permanent settlements.
My father died 20 years ago, and we were very small. We were all children, four children with our mother. And my mother wasn't working. Then we grew up and we began to work until we could make our house completely with its furniture and to live like the other people, not the high society, but like other people. And now at once, all of it together, nothing at all, under the sun, under the sky.
Conditions in the camps are not suitable, and the residents are under economic pressure.
They are frustrated, you see, and I think these people have lost confidence in everybody in this world.
Palestinian fighters based in Jordan infiltrate their motherland and carry out armed operations. In March 1968, after the armed operations of the fighters, Israel attacks the Palestinian camp Karameh in Jordan and destroys everything. In the aftermath, tensions increase. Palestinian fighters are transferred to Lebanon. The economic and social conditions in Lebanon are not suitable. Social activists such as Imam Musa Sadr strive for unity, coherence, and alleviation of deprivation. But the political groups are not united. They do not have long-term plans. Each group in front is seeking its own fame and benefit. They compete with each other and do not tolerate one another's presence. Worst of all, they do not realize Israel's policies. On the 3rd of April, 1975, leader of a Christian party was the subject of an assassination attempt, but he survives unharmed. In retaliation for this attack, Palestinian fighters are attacked the same day. The clashes escalate and the civil wars in Lebanon begin. Imam Musa Sadr's plans are adversely influenced.
18 months of bitter fighting saw the Christians' very existence threatened.
Israel, which hails the war and turmoil in Lebanon, implements its own plans. In 1978, Israel attacks Lebanon under the pretext of preventing Palestinian attacks.
Now, if you like to come with me, I will show you where the airplanes are shooting the people. Exactly, you can see with your eyes, you see? That's what I like you to prove, that to all the people. No bread, no food, not even water, no electricity, nothing, nothing. We are alone. We have nothing. We need everything.
Israel deploys a mercenary group in Lebanon and retreats from the country. In 1981, Menachem Begin, the Prime Minister of Israel, appoints one of his most ruthless individuals as the Minister of Military Affairs, Ariel Sharon. Sharon had a long history of crime and violence and was known for saying, "Destroy everything that can be destroyed." Sharon designs a plan not only to put an end to Palestinian resistance, but also to change the geographical shape of the region. Initially, Israel launches scattered attacks, and finally, on June 6, 1982, a widespread attack begins. 120,000 soldiers, along with 3,200 tanks and armored vehicles, suddenly enter Lebanese territory. They quickly reach Palestinian camps in Sur and Sidon. The war breaks out and Palestinian fighters resist. At the same time, Israel also attacks Syrian forces. With pressure from Israel on the Lebanese parliament, Bashir Gemayel is elected as president. Israel's objectives for attacking Lebanon become clear: occupying Lebanese territory, expelling Palestinians, suppressing Syrians, and establishing a puppet government in Lebanon. At Lebanon's request, foreign forces enter to oversee the departure of Palestinians. After the departure of Palestinian fighters, foreign forces also leave Lebanon. Subsequent events quickly unfold. Bashir Gemayel is killed in a bombing. The Israelis immediately besiege the Palestinian camps. Then they incite the Phalangists to act against the Palestinians. The Phalangists enter the camps and carry out an unprecedented massacre. At that time, at least 90,000 Palestinians were in the camps, most of whom were 1948 refugees. The Israelis oversee the operations and even illuminate the camps at night with floodlights to continue the massacre even throughout the night. The killers carry fake identification cards, and it is never clear how many of them were Israelis and how many were Lebanese. Israel was intoxicated with victories. It called southern Lebanon the northern boundary of the Jordan River and beat the drum of victory. But these crimes had consequences. The region was awaiting new disasters. Heavy rain falls in the city of Tyre. Israeli soldiers gather inside the command building. Moments later, a vehicle enters the building and immediately explodes. 140 Israeli officers and soldiers are killed as a result of the intensity of the blast. Sometime later, in the spring of 1983, another explosion takes place. this time at the U.S. Embassy. In this explosion, CIA officers are also killed. This is considered the second attack on embassies. In the fall of 1983, two more explosions occur. The casualties of Israeli and American forces mount. Scattered attacks on Israeli forces continue. In 1984, Shia cleric Sheikh Raghib Harb is assassinated and martyred by three mercenaries. Following that, Israel attacks the villages, destroying homes and killing unarmed people. These events are considered part of Israel's revenge. In 1985, Hezbollah officially declares its existence in Lebanon and calls Israel an occupier. For the first time, Israel faces a cohesive, unified, and organized group. While the resistance force has shown itself off in Lebanon, despair and hopelessness prevail in Palestinian territories. No individual or organization is able or desires to help Palestine. The economic conditions of Palestinians worsens by the day. Zionist oppression and disrespect are darted towards Palestinian life. Palestinian workers are run over by a truck and four people are killed. Many others are injured and the community becomes infuriated. During the funerals, clashes erupt. Palestinians attack Israelis with stones. 17-year-old student Mohammed Hatem Abu Sisi is killed by Israel. The clash is heightened and people rise up in a revolutionary movement. The First Intifada. From within the First Intifada, the Hamas resistance movement led by Sheikh Ahmed Yassin takes shape. Israel wants to suppress the movement, but that is beyond its strength. The solution lies in negotiations. Israel needs peace to restore power. Israel's demands are met. The issue of Al-Quds and the return of Palestinians are set aside for the time being. The confrontation between the Palestine Liberation Organization, the PLO, and Israel comes to an end. A self-governing authority is formed, which is simply distant from the ideal of Al-Quds, aiming to pacify the Palestinians. This is considered a form of silent repression. When Israel feels safe from Palestinians, its attention turns away towards a new player from Lebanon, Hezbollah. During Israel's attacks, Lebanon's economic and social conditions were not favorable. Israel did whatever it wanted. It abducted ordinary people, murdering them in Lebanese territories. However, Hezbollah's resistance forces Israel to retreat. The first prisoner swap operation takes place. Hezbollah is able to free its forces from Israel. While everyone is celebrating Hezbollah's success, a bitter incident occurs. The Israeli army targets a car, killing its passengers. In this incident, Sayyid Abbas Mousawi, the Secretary General of Hezbollah, along with his family, are all martyred. Sayyid Abbas Mousawi was aware of the dangers, but he had decided to be with his family despite Israel's probable attack. As the leader of Hezbollah martyred, Israel thought the job was done. However, subsequent events show strategic miscalculation on Israel's part. In the 1990s, Hezbollah's resistance continues. Israel decides to directly fight Hezbollah. Israel's military attack on Lebanon starts under the pretext of Hezbollah's dangers to Israel. The attack is called Operation Grapes of Wrath. Lebanon is heavily bombarded. Amid the bitter incidents, a more tragic event than war occurs. A group of defenseless people is settled in a place called Qana, where only women and children are present. Qana is attacked, and Lebanese women and children are martyred. The terrifying tragedy burdened Israel with immense pressure. The war is halted by Hezbollah's resistance. In 1999, a piece of news is published in the media. The infiltration of Israeli forces into Lebanese territory has been met with failure. This incident is unbelievable. Hezbollah's success lies in its media portrayal of its victories. Hezbollah releases various images of its operations, which reveal the realities of the battlefield. The media operations increase Israel's costs, and in 2000, Israel withdraws from Lebanon and adopts a policy of assassination. Shortly after, Sheikh Ahmed Yassin, leader of Hamas, is assassinated. Then Rafik Hariri, the prime minister of Lebanon, is liquidated. In 2006, while Hezbollah is accused of involvement in the assassinations and media attacks against it soar, an incident occurs at the borders. Israeli soldiers on patrol at the Lebanese border are attacked. Two Israeli soldiers are taken captive. The Zionists quickly react, but Israel's reaction comes with casualties. Israel declares war on Lebanon and attacks Lebanon by land, sea, and air, especially on the southern area of Beirut, Dahiyeh. The 33-day war begins. The casualties of the 33-day war are numerous. However, the important point is Hezbollah does not surrender and responds to Israeli attacks in every possible way. Although the war does not yield any achievements for Israel, it keeps on attacking everywhere. In fact, Israel's war plan was somewhat similar to America's military operations in Serbia and Afghanistan. But this plan is doomed to failure. Experts believe Israeli attack on Lebanon was a mistake. However, hardliners did not allow the right decisions to be made. They were the ones who said Israel needed to show its strength to restore its image after the events of 2000 and the withdrawal from Lebanon. They said Israel's goal is to display power. America supported Israel's policy and, along with Britain, blocked a ceasefire in the hope that Hezbollah might suffer defeat. They thought that roughly within a week, everything would come to an end. But it was not so. Israel was defeated in this war. Martyr Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, then the Secretary General of Hezbollah, was giving a speech, and in every speech, he struck a blow to Israel. Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah's revelations about Israel ended up with Israel's loss. Israel also suffered a defeat in politics. Hezbollah did not want and would not allow the bitter memories of the 1967 war to be repeated. revisiting reports conducted by Israelis, depicts the real scene of the battle. Hezbollah and Hamas capture Israeli soldiers. Israel comes into play. However, its tanks are being destroyed one by one. The casualty rate rises. The Israeli Air Force gets into action. Then Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert threatens to wage full-scale war on Lebanon. Other than targeting Hezbollah in southern Lebanon, they attack any target in Lebanon. Another Israeli official says if Hezbollah soldiers do not retreat, they will turn Lebanon back 20 years. All the events happen quickly, and Israeli authorities make decisions rapidly and implement each decision right away. In the middle of the war, it becomes clear that Israeli analysts were right. Waging war on Lebanon was a mistake. In contrast to Israel's hasty decisions, Hezbollah had a special order and discipline. But Israel was not ready to accept defeat. It attacked relentlessly. The war continues. In the heat of Israel's attacks, an Israeli warship in the Mediterranean Sea explodes. Israel is caught off guard. Observers realize something has changed in Hezbollah's battle with Israel. But the Israeli regime doesn't realize that. An Israeli soldier later says, "We didn't know what was happening and what was hitting us. We only knew that we were being killed." They thought that perhaps Hezbollah forces were stationed in desert tents with AK-47s, but during the military attack, the soldiers were faced with hydraulic steel doors and a network of intricate tunnels. An Israeli soldier later confesses, "I am ashamed to admit that we drank water from Hezbollah's headquarters and went into local shops to eat." Of course, Israeli soldiers looted the shops. The advice of people like then Israeli War Minister Benjamin Ben Eliezer for the attack from the beginning was wrong. America is pursuing a rapid ceasefire because Israel needs to make up for its lost power. During the talks, Israel attacks again. But this attack also fails, and Israel is forced to accept a UN resolution. In the final 72 hours of the war, Israel launches around 1 million cluster bombs. The number of cluster bombs is so high that even after the ceasefire, ordinary people were falling victim to these bomblets and killed. But this does not hide Israel's defeat from the eyes of experts. Experts said that Hezbollah did a great job. Hezbollah is not afraid of Israel. The 33-day war becomes Israel's first defeat. Later, American journalist Seymour Hersh reveals the Bush administration was closely involved in planning Israel's military operations. The war with Hezbollah was a simulation of America's attack on Iran's nuclear facilities, and it was considered a kind of exercise. According to experts, the 33-day war becomes a turning point in the military and war equations and has a significant impact on the region's subsequent events. Ben-Gurion believed that Israel should not be defeated in any war. And if defeated, it will be victorious in no war afterwards.
علم فقه از علوم شریفه اسلامی است.
فقه or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked among
پیغمبر اکرم نمونه.
The holy prophet of Islam is the example
of عمل انسان بعد از ایمان.
Self purification is the most significant fact.
امامت یک اصل زنده است در تاریخ اسلام.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Nasiri. Please stay tuned.
غیبت یکی از عواملی است که بین همین دوستان جدایی میاندازه. غیبت اینه.
One of the negative effects of backbiting is separating friends from each other. It is also recommended in the Quran and narrations to avoid backbiting. When someone backbites others, he or she is in fact removing the love and kindness between believers. For instance, if you have two friends or brothers in faith, and a third person backbites one of them, then that would be the start for separation between them.
IRIB English Radio. Please follow our radio programs and podcasts on iranradio.ir.
خدا و پیغمبر الفت و محبت ایجاد کرده، من آمدم اینو جدا کردم از هم.
Now, this person must regret his actions because he is destroying the bonds that Allah and Prophet established among believers. Therefore, it is mentioned in the Holy Quran not to backbite behind your brother or sister in faith. Backbiting is forbidden in Islam. It is explicitly mentioned in the Holy Quran that if someone backbites others, it is as if he or she is eating the flesh of a dead corpse. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Nasiri. Till another episode and another short speech of a great alim or a scholar, fi amanillah, God bless you all.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime's finance minister has dared to suggest a plan to expand illegal Zionist settlements in the occupied West Bank. Concerning this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote, "The Zionist regime finance minister has dared to suggest a plan to expand illegal Zionist settlements in the occupied West Bank as a sign to the entire world that a Palestinian state will not be established." The Zionist regime's finance minister Bezalel Smotrich called for the full annexation of the occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip, asserting the need to establish illegal Israeli settlements in the heart of Palestinian territories, and the expulsion of Palestinian nationalists. And that's according to the Middle East Monitor report. The far-right minister told an American evangelical audience at the Middle East summit in occupied Al-Quds that Israeli presence must be solidified in Gaza by creating a lasting Israeli civilian and military presence and the establishment of settlements in the enclave. The leader of the far-right religious Zionist party asserted that any military gains in Gaza could not be maintained unless there was an Israeli civilian presence in the Gaza Strip. He claimed, "Where there is no civilian presence, there is no long-term military presence, there is no security, and there is an existential threat to the State of Israel and its citizens, and we must not allow this." Smotrich brushed off the idea of a two-state solution, telling the audience that Israel should be upfront about rejecting a Palestinian state. The Times of Israel reported that the finance minister suggested instead a plan to expand illegal Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank as a sign to the entire world that a Palestinian state will not be established. Smotrich went on to claim that Palestinians in the occupied Palestinian territories should only be granted limited local self-rule, devoid of national characteristics, while expelling any Palestinian with national aspirations. Middle East Monitor reported, "Those who do not want or are unable to put aside their national ambitions will receive assistance from us to emigrate to one of the many Arab countries where the Arabs can realize their national ambitions, or to any one other destination in the world." Other far-right speakers at the conference, which was organized by the Orthodox Jewish institution Israel 365, also dismissed the idea of a Palestinian state. The head of the Zionist regime's far-right New Hope Party, Gideon Sar, was one of those. He reportedly called on the Zionist regime to reject any form of concessions to the Palestinians, encouraging the Tel Aviv regime to adopt instead a political iron wall in the face of international pressure to on the establishment of a two-state solution. Saar was quoted as saying, "There will never be any substitute for full operational Israeli military control of the territory from the sea to Jordan." For his part, religious Zionism member Ohad Tal stated that there can be Jewish sovereignty from the river to the sea. He claimed, some will say this is not realistic, and we respond that the two-state scenario has itself proven to be a dangerous delusion. Also adding, others will say that the world will not permit it, and we respond that once the Jewish people is determined that this is the right way, no obstacle is too great to be overcome. The recent claims of the controversial finance minister come in line with previous statements he has made along with other far-right Zionist regime figures. In a recent interview with the Franco-German art reportage channel, Smotrich called for Israel to expand its borders to the Jordan River, as well as to the Syrian capital Damascus and other countries as far as Iraq and Saudi Arabia. His ambitions and that of several others of the current far-right Zionist regime government to achieve the Greater Israel Project came in an interview for the recently released documentary titled Israel Extremists in Power with Art. The far-right Zionist minister told Art, "I want a Jewish state that operates according to the values of Jewish people." At one point in the interview, the journalist asked Smotrich if today's borders should be expanded beyond the river in the next stage. "Okay, bit by bit," he replied, and said, "It is written that the future of Jerusalem is to expand to Damascus." Smotrich claimed, "Only Jerusalem until Damascus." This exchange between the Zionist regime's finance minister and the reporter is followed by a revelation by the documentary narrator, who says that Bezalel Smotrich has a radical vision for the promised land, and it includes all Palestinian lands, but also territories in Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, Egypt, even in Saudi Arabia. He concludes by stating that it certainly is an extremist vision, but it is an accepted one in Israel's public discourse. Many Zionist extremist leaders have voiced their ambitions publicly of a so-called Greater Israel since the start of genocide on the besieged Gaza Strip on October 7, 2023. On September 27th, the Zionist regime's prime minister, child killer Benjamin Netanyahu, displayed at the United Nations General Assembly session a map that included the occupied West Bank and Gaza as part of the fabricated regime of Israel. The Zionist regime prime minister held two maps, which both placed Gaza and the West Bank as an integral part of the Zionist regime. A year earlier, child killer Netanyahu spoke at the same forum and displayed a map that of what he called the so-called New Middle East, which also included the West Bank and Gaza as part of Israel. Since the Zionist regime's genocide in Gaza, neither Israeli regime leaders nor troops or regular Israeli citizens have been timid about posting footage on the different social media outlets expressing their ambitions of a so-called Greater Israel project.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers, dear sisters, salamun alaikum, so welcome. Today we have another interesting story on Lantern, this program. So we go for this story.
Ali's Way or Training. The city of Kufa was the capital of the Islamic government. People from all over the world used to gather at that point to get the benefit of knowledge and learning from that great Islamic university. One of those days, two men came across each other in the vicinity of the city. One of them was Ali, the commander of the faithful, peace be upon him, and the other was a Christian who did not recognize him. The Christian man was moving toward the suburban area of Kufa, whereas Ali ibn Abi Talib was on his way to Kufa. They mutually agreed to accompany each other for a while, talking to each other so that they do not get tired. They reach a point where two ways split out, so that each one wanted to move one another in those two different roads. The Christian bade farewell and went on his way, but he observed that his Muslim companion, whose way was on the opposite side, was moving towards him. So he stopped and questioned him. "Don't you want to go to Kufa?" Ali ibn Abi Talib said. "Yes," the Christian man said. "Then why are you coming towards this direction?" Ali alayhi salam replied, "I wish to accompany you to a certain length of distance because our Prophet said, when two persons are together on a way, on a journey, companions, they get a right over each other. Now that you have got a right upon me, I go along with you up to a certain distance, so that I must pay you discharge that light of yours in this world. Then I will part off on my own way." The Christian man was much pleased and moved by his humanly attitude and conduct, and he liked this talk and said, "It's benefiting that I should also embrace Islam, which has such a culture and students." His amazement and astonishment was only too enhanced when he discovered that his travel companion is Ali, the ruler of Islam. So he immediately accepted and embraced Islam at his hand.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله Dear audience, welcome to a new episode of Lantern from iranradio.ir. Well, in this program, what we do is to listen to certain religious stories and then try to elaborate and talk some more details about these stories and the themes and lessons that we can take in order to make use of them as Muslims in our lives. Well, this episode of Lantern is about Imam Ali alayhi salam and non-Muslims. You know, in fact, we want to elaborate on the way the non-Muslims viewed Imam Ali alayhi salam and the way that he treated them on their country. You know, Imam Ali alayhi salam was so popular even among the non-Muslims that when he died, all the Christians, Jews came to Kufa, and particularly the women and children who were personally looked after by Imam Ali alayhi salam. They lamented his death and wept as one does for one's father. You know, mourning was observed even in Jerusalem, and the Lord Bishop also could not restrain his tears. You know, all the outstanding ulama, including Shia and Sunni in the religion of Islam, even the non-Muslim scholars have said that they are all unable to understand the spiritual position of the commander of the faithful personality. This part of the life of Imam Ali alayhi salam catches everyone's eye with its loftiness and enlightenment. They cannot understand the different dimensions of his life. This is one part of his life. When Ibn Abi al-Hadid, a Sunni and Mu'tazili scholar, narrated one of the sermons of the commander of the faithful, which is about monotheism, in his commentary on Nahj al-Balagha, he says, Ibrahim al-Khalil al-Rahman should be proud of having such a son. You know, many prophets emerged from Ibrahim's descendants. However, he says that this is only about the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali alayhi salam. He says, Ibrahim al-Khalil al-Rahman should say to this son of his, you made certain statements in your monotheism sermon about the Arabs' follies. I could not make such statements about Nabt that are a Bani Israel tribe follies, and I could not illustrate the same truth as you did.
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we look at the story which indicates a moral aspect of our life.
So you see, you notice that the narrator is a Sunni person and a Mu'tadi scholar. This is one part and one chapter of the Commander of the Faithful's life, and it has many unknown dimensions, and this part of his life is really a deep ocean. You know, most of non-Muslim thinkers believe that Imam Ali alayhi salam was the last opportunity for humanity to learn from him and to be raised by him on the special morals entitled justice and equality among all humans, as his thought was the essence of the religions that all the prophets brought and which Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam learned from their sources. So he was the best student for the greatest teachers. He deserved to be called the educator of nations. And this is how he is described by the non-Muslims, you know, not we Shias who are just strong, you know, follower of him. No, not us, but the people who do not believe in the religion of Islam or Shia school of thought. So unfortunately, the nations, starting from his own one in his time, did not follow or obey him, and the citizens of the country weren't at level of his thoughts, philosophy and justice. And because of that, Imam Ali alayhi salam was martyred before he built the virtuous city in the souls of the members of the human community, since building a righteous and virtuous person for the Imam alayhi salam is the origin of the urbanism and civilization, the pillar of states, and immunity to justice and equality. These are considered as the immunity to the ruler and the ruled, and the basis of the true virtuous city, and its shield that protects it from becoming an empire of oppression and darkness. Okay, dear listeners, that was the time we had for this episode of Lantern. I really hope that you have enjoyed listening to this episode. Until another one, I bid you farewell and may Allah protect you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
ألا بذكر الله تطمئن القلوب.
In the limelight.
China and Latin America share a history of resisting colonialism and exploitation by foreign powers and are now aligned in promoting a multipolar world order. The rhetoric of a new Cold War driven by neo-filibusters along the revival of the Monroe Doctrine stands in direct opposition to Latin America's aspirations for sovereignty and cooperative development. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Global Times wrote, right after Brazilian agriculture minister proposed that Brazil should join the Belt and Road Initiative, BRI, to counter protectionist measures from the U.S. and EU, U.S. Trade Representative Catherine Tai responded, saying Brazil should consider the risks of joining the BRI before making any final decision. Tai's rhetoric and anxiety are hardly new. During the Aspen Security Forum in July, U.S. General Laura Richardson, the commander of the United States Southern Command, responsible for overseeing operations across Latin America and the Caribbean, criticized the growing collaboration between China and the region. She suggested that a new Marshall Plan for Latin America could serve as a countermeasure to initiatives such as the BRI. In August, Richardson told attendees at the South American Defense Conference in Santiago, Chile, that SouthDEC is a call for action for team democracy to work overtime together to confront unfolding threats in the region. These statements are part of a broader U.S. strategy to revive Cold War-era rhetoric under the guise of a new Cold War, echoing the principles of the Monroe Doctrine and allying with U.S. efforts to curb China's growing influence. Unsurprisingly, this rhetoric has intensified alongside the strengthening of relations between China and Latin America. Globally, the hardening of the U.S. stance toward China has become increasingly evident. Successive U.S. administrations have taken progressively tougher measures, from the trade war to initiatives like Quad and AUKUS, all aimed at increasing diplomatic, economic, and military pressure on China. In Latin America, this strategy has materialized through frequent remarks by high-ranking U.S. officials questioning the intentions behind China's cooperation projects, often accompanied by accusations of Chinese imperialism or neocolonialism in the region and invoking myths such as the debt trap. These efforts have specifically targeted China's involvement in Panama Canal and various infrastructure projects across the region, culminating in U.S. diplomatic attempts to block the adoption of Huawei's 5G technology in Latin American telecommunications networks. Despite U.S. efforts, Latin American governments and their citizens appear increasingly indifferent to such appeals, choosing instead to strengthen ties with China, South America's largest trading partner and the second largest for Latin America overall. With more than 20 Latin American and Caribbean countries already